You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Giro d'Italia in association with Rafa. From grand tours to group rides, the Champs-Élysées to coffee stops, Rafa exists to celebrate the world's most beautiful sport. Today we are in Zappada.
Cozze, citere, cozze, cozze, piscine, nu spicudeci cora, nu spicudeci cora. Cozze, citere, cozze, cozze, piscine, nu spicudeci cora, se nu mangiano le femmine.
Hello, my name is the Flying Haggis, and I'm with the Watford Sausage Roll.
Oh, no.
Are you going to call me Berlin?
I haven't Bratwurst got hot dog. No. I don't know what I'm going to... Yeah, okay, that'll
the
do.
The Coventry something. The what?
Berlin Bratwurst. On that subject...
Right. Always not, gets getting to pick his own nickname.
Typical, isn't it?
On that subject, it's not... When I say that tonight, it's Guten Abend, because we're in the German-speaking part of Italy. Always surprises
well,
you'd people.
You'd never know, would you? Well, Bayern Munich flags all over the place here.
Yeah, I think it always surprises people to learn that there is a part of Italy that is rigorously German-speaking. And we're in it tonight. We're in a place called Niederdorf, literally translated Villa Bassa. Everyone's speaking German.
It's well, weird, the only it? Place in Italy where they'll be looking forward to the Football World Cup, I guess, this Whoa. Summer.
They're not actually German, Lionel. They're still Italian.
But they do support Germany, though, don't they?
No, they don't.
Do they not?
No.
They support Bayern Munich. So anyway, we're this is a cycling podcast.
Oh, yeah.
And we are talking about the Giro d'Italia, which another thrilling stage of that today. We'll be saying arrivederci to Lionel at the end of Guten Tag.
I'm going to drop the mic. I'm just going to drop the mic and walk out.
Don't do that. Give us the tale of the tapa, please. I'll be taking this over, I guess, or maybe Daniel will in your absence.
Yeah, I'll really be listening.
Not really up my street, is it?
What? Giving a factual account of the day's racing for the benefit of the listeners? No, not really. No. stage 15, Tom Mezzo.
Anyway, go on. Go on, Lionel. Before you go.
Go on. Oh, no. It's all gone so well.
No,
if, a crowd, eh?
if on any episode I get the last word, it's today. Tolmezzo to Zappada, 176 kilometres, a really fast first hour of racing and a fast last hour of racing as well, and a significant one. Simon Yates won his third stage of this Giro, third one whilst wearing the pink jersey, extended his lead over Tom Dumoulin. Gained in total with the time bonus another 47 seconds, so the time gap now between Yates and Dumoulin is 2:11, and I'm already taking bets on whether what's the likelihood of the time trial gap being 2:11 in Dumoulin's favour on Tuesday. We could be all square with five to play. It could be
could be dormy.
It sounds like speculation.
It does. But it was a day that was shaped by a very large break. Some of the names that were in there: Quintana, Modolo, Brambilla, Dents, Lutsenko, Nylands, DeMarchi, Bonifazio, Ballerini, Masnada again, Nibali, Visconti, Ciccone, Barbin, and
one
so
thing
on.
I won't do in my tale of the tapas is list the everyone in a breakaway of this size.
Of 25 riders. No, well, I'm not either. I'm leaving it there. Ulysses, Stibar and Hermann were also in there.
Just because you think we're in Germany doesn't mean you need to be that pernickety. Anyway.
No national stereotyping, please, Daniel. Least of all about your very generous hosts who allow you to live in their country. The race. Can you tell I've caught the sun today? I may be slightly delirious, or perhaps it's an end of term feeling for me. I don't know. Anyway, the race really broke down to small groups from that break. At one point, Cherel and Dents, the two AG2R riders, were ahead with Quintana, and Woods and Nibali were chasing behind. Woods, of course, had come up from the bunch. He wasn't in the original break. And then the last men standing really were Dents and Ciccone, but it was the race for the overall that really ignited on the approach to Zappada. And Simon Yates seized his opportunity brilliantly, didn't he? He made one move and was kind of reeled back in, and then he made another decisive move. And for a long while, Tom Dumoulin was trying to chase. It was not just Yates against Dumoulin, really, but Dumoulin had Pino, Pozzovivo, Lopez and Calapaz in his slipstream. The Chris Froome was dropped and lost more time, and Tom Dumoulin struggled. I mean, he'd done so much chasing when the pace then lifted, or maybe the gradient changed, he lost contact with that group and managed to fight his way back. But as I say, Yates now leads by 2:11. A few shuffling lower down the GC. Lopez is up from 6th to 5th. Carapaz is up from 7th to 6th. And that's because Froome has fallen from 5th to 7th and is now 4:52 behind. So having hauled himself back in to the contention yesterday by winning on Montes Oncalant, he's now back on the fringes of it all again. So a really exciting and fairly dramatic and possibly pivotal day in the Giro. Do you reckon?
Where's Pino, Lionel, on GC?
Pino is fourth at 3:37. Pozzovivo third at 2:28. The gaps are opening up, and it's all because of Simon Yates's aggression today. He attacked and didn't look back.
He's now won two back-to-back Tirreno Adriaticos, hasn't he? I mean,
pretty much.
Today was the most significant stage in terms of time gain.
He could easily, Lionel and I were saying in the car, that he could easily have five stage wins by now. He gifted one to Esteban Chavez. He came within probably a few hundred metres. If the Zonkland had been a few hundred metres longer, he would have got another one yesterday. And he's completely dominated this race.
But he has to, doesn't he? I mean, this is the only option open to him if he wants to win overall. And it's no surprise that this is what he's going to try to do, because Matt White particularly has said it's from the very start.
It's
they would try to take
it?
Seconds all the time. Because but to pull it off...
I was saying yesterday about the time, how I'm looking forward to the time trial. I can't even remember if this was in the episode or just conversation, and how unusual it is to look forward to the time trial. It's not the time trial that I'm looking forward to. It's the effect the time trial's had on the rest of the race. The time trial has made the rest of the race really exciting, because it's been looming there for 2 weeks, and it's clearly been the incentive for Simon Yates to just get as much of a buffer as he can. He sat there in the press conference tonight, said he's got 2:11 on Dumoulin, but that could literally evaporate on Tuesday in the time trial. Tuesday, If Dumoulin is at his best, as he was at the World Championships last year, for example, where he took over a minute out of Froome, I think, that's good by memory, you would fancy him to take at least 2 minutes out of Simon Yates. In the current form that both are in, and Dumoulin did look tired today, it could be less than a minute. It could be 45 seconds or something.
Yeah, that's the point we made, I think, just before you came back out, Rich, that 2 weeks into the race, and after two difficult mountain stages and a rest day, we don't know the effect the rest day will have on the riders. It's really in the realm of the unpredictable. And Simon Yates, if he rides really well and limits those losses to, I don't know, a minute and a quarter or something, the complexion of the race will look very, very different going into the final stages. But equally, if he has a bad day and performs as he sometimes has in time trials, and loses, say, 3 minutes, then we've got a really, we've got an excellent race on our hands. But the thing about the time trial is we just don't know how Yates will respond after the aggression that he's shown on so many days.
And let's not forget, there has been this big focus on the time trial. We're just over halfway through the Giro in terms of climbing. You know, there's as much to come, really, in terms of climbing.
Well,
and for me, the big question is, can Yates maintain this form that he's in, this incredible form that he's in, for a third week, you know? And I don't think that's a given at all. I mean, the guys he's up against are all proven three-week riders. I spoke to Matt White at the finish, his sports director. I mean, Matt White is always fairly upbeat, positive, enthusiastic guy, but he was bouncing off the walls, had there been walls, we were speaking outside. But he was, you know, he's enjoying this immensely and feels increasingly confident that Simon Yates can win the Giro. One thing before we hear from him, this was conversation off the tape, but significant, I think, that he knew his eight riders in November. You know, we had him over in London, and he knew the eight riders that were going to ride in November. And speaking to other riders about that, that's very, very unusual for riders to know what they're doing as far back as that and to be able to prepare for it. And so that's one thing I think that's counted in their favour. The other thing, he said that on the Zonkeland, he told all his riders to sit up, apart from Simon Yates, obviously, because they were leading the team competition and he didn't want them to be thinking about the team competition at all. Sky and Astana are both taking that quite seriously because it's an opportunity for them to win something. So he didn't want them distracted by that. So he said Zonkalan Day ended up being, you know, quite easy for a lot of his team, apart from Simon Yates. So let's hear from Matt White at the finish.
Matt, another fascinating stage. It looked, when Simon attacked there, like it was a plan. He seemed to be very, very, he knew what he was doing.
Yeah, we knew. We wanted to test people on the climb, whether it was for the win or whether it was for just to see who was having a bad day. That was always the plan today. It was a strange race today because it took, I think, 75 kilometres for the race to go. And I think a lot of guys were pretty pinned when the break had finally gone. So our plan was either going to be to put guys under pressure for the win or whether it was at 6 minutes, 7 minutes. But yeah, look, Simon's got incredible legs. And our tactics haven't changed since the start. Whenever we get an opportunity, we have to try to test the time trials, especially.
I mean, everybody's talking about Zonkalan. And if we look at these two stages now, this one has proved more significant in terms of time. Is that a surprise?
A little bit. On one hand, a little bit. But I think the thing is not so much, some guys haven't recovered as well as others after the Zonkalan. And it's the end of the second week. People are getting tired. Yesterday was, I'm certainly not going to say an easy stage, but it was one big sustained climb for those guys. You know, for the GC guys, it wasn't a hard day. It was a hard final. Then you throw in a very hard day on the back of it. That's what made the difference. That's what made it so tough today.
And today, when Simon was attacking like that, was the thinking that perhaps one of the other, you know, Pino or Pots of Evo or someone might go with him and put Dumoulin in trouble? Were you surprised to see him take off on his own in the way that he did?
No, not at all. No. We were going to throw it out there, and if someone came across to us, if there was a combination, then it was going to obviously work with us. We were hoping that either Dumoulin or Froome could go across, and then we could put time on one of those guys. And instead, they both couldn't match us, and it's worked out quite well.
I mean, you've been in a position before where you've been up there in Grand Tours, but you've never been in this position before. You had, obviously, Chavez in pink for a day a couple of years ago. How are you finding this situation that you're in now, of having had the pink jersey for a long time, the team doing a lot of work every day? How are you and the rest of the team coping with that?
Yeah, really well. I'm personally really enjoying it. And the guys, you know, we picked a very, very strong team, and I'd be nervous if I didn't have faith in my boys, and I know what they're capable of doing, and I know the condition they're in. So it's just been really exciting for us, and it's taking one day at a time. But even today was a day that we found he's getting better. He's getting better, or people aren't recovering as good. I don't know what it is, but he's in a great place. We've got still a lot of work to do, but I'm confident of the guys around him. And our focus now is on the time trial and limiting our losses before we go back into the mountains again.
Well, it seems a lot of people's focus has been on the time trial. We've been talking about the time trial a lot, and clearly the strategy for Simon has been to get as much of a buffer before that. Yeah. But there's still a long way to go after that. There's still tough stages. How confident are you that he can hold on to this incredible form that he's got for another week?
Very. There's no reason for it to go anywhere. We had a really specific preparation for here. We had a good break after Paris-Nice and Catalunya. And him and his coach have really nailed the preparation. And I don't see it going anywhere between now and Rome.
A San Francisco.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast today, and Science and Sport sponsor us. And if you'd like to win some Rafa and Science and Sport swag, please retweet tonight's episode and add a short comment stating why you listen to the cycling podcast, along with the hashtag Giro101. So if you'd like to just leave a little comment with a retweet for the episode, that would be great. And one of those comments will be chosen at random to win some very, very nice Rafa and Science and Sport stuff. Lots of you have been doing that the last couple of weeks. We're very grateful for that. And I think it's a sort of special prize this week. It gets better each week, so some really nice stuff on offer. We'll be doing our press conference again tomorrow, answering your questions. Phone in. The number is on our Twitter biog. And still on Rafa, Lionel, you presented Sam Bennett with his Pedlar de Charme t-shirt this morning.
I did, and we'll hear a bit from Sam Bennett in tomorrow's Kilometer Zero, which is basically about the Montes Oncalan. Richard, you spoke with another Irish rider, Ryan Mullen, rides for Trek Segafredo, I believe the heaviest rider in the race.
Ireland had the tallest rider at the Vuelta, and they have the heaviest rider at the Giro, I believe.
And it's kind of a bit of atmosphere from on top of the mountain as well. So that will be out for Friends of the Podcast tomorrow morning.
Indeed. So we heard from Matt White before the break. He, as you heard, is very, very confident, excited. You know, they've been there or thereabouts the last few years in Grand Tours. They had the pink jersey with Esteban Chavez for one day at the Giro 2 years ago. But this, you know, that he feels that it's almost within touching distance. I that's my impression anyway, which, you know, there's still a third of the race to
touching
go.
Touching distance for someone with really long arms, like maybe Mr. Tickle from the Mr. Men, you know, or Inspector Gadget. I don't know. I mean, a week to go. That's touching distance with a week to go. I don't know.
I'm putting words in his mouth. Yeah. He didn't say that. I should clarify.
No, but
that was my impression.
But he's got himself into an absolutely brilliant position, really. If you said to him back in, well, remember back in Jerusalem, Rich, when we saw the time trial results and saw how well he'd ridden, seventh, I think he was there. Clearly,
Simon Yates.
Clearly arrived at the race in great form, and that's the big question mark, isn't it? We've mentioned it already. How will he respond in this final week? But he couldn't have manoeuvred himself into much better of a position by this stage. 2:11 over Dumoulin is significant, I would say. He had to, and eking it out with by landing consistent blows, doing something on every opportunity that he's had a chance to do something. You know, that's what's most impressive about it.
And it was impressive today, the way that he, you know, attacked on the climb and held his advantage on the flat. And I saw a few comments about that, given the calibre of the riders behind, but they weren't actually chasing. That was the problem. I think they were all looking to Dumoulin to chase, and Dumoulin was either unable or unwilling to do so, and nobody else was going to commit without Dumoulin fully committing, but I don't think Dumoulin was able to fully commit.
Well, we drove down Zapata, down against the way the race came on our way out of town this evening, and I was surprised how steep it was. It really didn't look like that on TV. So the advantage was definitely with Yates there, absolutely made for him, that kind of climb. And it is interesting that today's stage has done a lot more damage than Montes Oncalan, because it was a racer stage, and when there was an opportunity to race, he took it on. You know, he was reeled back in the first time, gradually, and then went again. And, you know, that's somebody who very confident in his ability. But you're absolutely right. Dumoulin didn't really have any help from the other riders with him, all of whom had something to gain or lose. And in a way, I think Dumoulin, I said to you, Rich, he got hung out to dry like yesterday's washing, really, by the rest of the group. Because he was in a no-win situation. If he sat and watched as the gap went maybe a minute more, he would have been criticised for that, because the onus is on him to chase. But he did all that work and got no assistance for it, then had to fight his way back on when he got dropped. You know, there was no real answer to what he could do. But what was interesting was that Sunweb had looked so aggressive early on, hadn't they? They'd done a lot of work trying to whittle down the group earlier on in the stage.
He's wanting to hog it, isn't he? His last podcast.
I'm off. Aren't I? I mean, you're not here for me for a week.
get your fill of Lionel Burney tonight.
I was just looking at the respective time trial records of Dumoulin and Yates. It won't surprise you to hear that it's 8-0 to Dumoulin in time trials. I think the best precedent, the best reference, is the final time trial of the Tour de France last year in Marseille, which was only 23 kilometres, and Dumoulin wasn't there. But Yates lost, around about a minute and a half over 23 kilometres. So I think 2 minutes over 30 kilometres is probably about right. And he also generally loses, or has lost, about 3 seconds per kilometre to Dumoulin in time trial. So if that's the case, do the math. Minute and a half.
Dumoulin.
do the math. Yeah,
do the math. Well, shall we hear from the Dumoulin camp? We'll hear from Dumoulin and from his coach at Team Sunweb. That's what they call them, isn't it? Coaches.
He's the team coach. He's not Tom Dumoulin's
Brian
personal
Stevens
coach.
Brian Stevens is now at Team Sunweb, which I didn't realise.
Who's Brian Stevens?
Neil Stevens' brother.
All right.
Who used to be at British Cycling and was running the academy at British Cycling last year. But I realised this week that he has now joined Team Sunweb, and I've been looking for him to try and grab a word with him. But he's a very experienced coach. And we spoke at the finish. Well, I spoke to Mark Reef, and you grabbed some words from Tom Dumoulin. Shall we hear from Dumoulin first and then from Mark Reef?
I don't know. He's in such great shape that maybe he can also do a really, really good time trial. So we just have to see. I'll just give everything on Tuesday, and then I will see. Even if I have an excellent TT and he doesn't, and I take the lead, then it's going to be how it is now. He's just riding away from us whenever he wants, so then it's going to be very difficult. It's a long way to Rome, and I'm just giving everything every day, and then we will see in about a week. It was a hard day for everyone, and you see that Froome also felt, I think, the Zonkerland from yesterday, a little bit in his legs. And yeah, that's cycling. You have to, especially in a Grand Tour, it's hard every day.
Mark, could I ask, you had Sam doing quite a lot of work a bit earlier on in the stage. What was the thinking there?
That was a call of Tom. We were more behind at that moment. And I think that to keep the pace maybe the same, to show also the rest that we are still there, that Tom is still there. So that was, I think, the idea. But this is better maybe when he's here to ask that.
How difficult an opponent is Simon Yates for a rider like Tom? You know, the sort of skills that he has in on the climbs, as we saw today.
Yeah, he's showing that that he is by far the strongest at this moment in the mountains, and that's not something where you can do something about. And the only thing what you can do, what Tom can do, is to fight until the line, and that is what he did today. And then you have to see what the gap is in the end, and that is 41 seconds, and you see now 2:11. Time trial is still coming. There are still difficult mountain stages coming up, but we also have to see if Yates can continue like this for 3 weeks. He's having pink already for a while. Also, that pressure is playing a role. So maybe in the third week he's getting. We just have to hope for a weak moment of him, and then everything is still possible. The finish is in Rome and not here today.
How is Tom's condition this year compared to last year?
I think that he is pretty good. On the mountains he's showing a step forward if you compare that to last year. The only thing is that there are less time trial kilometers and more mountain finishes. That's the big difference, and you cannot compare a year to a year with on a parcours, but we see that if you compare a little bit the field from last year to this year, he just made a step forward on the mountains.
So that was a bit of Tom Dumoulin and then Mark Reef. Reef was interesting because I asked him about the decision to have Sam Omen at the front riding quite hard when he was Dumoulin's last teammate before Simon Yates attacked. It seemed to be sending a message that that they were taking control of the race, I suppose. But I wondered at the wisdom of that, given that he was Dumoulin's final teammate. And it seemed from what Mark Reef said there, it maybe wasn't entirely clear in the interview, but I think it was Dumoulin's decision to have Sam Omen riding on the front, and it wasn't a decision made by the team. And I got the sense that the team were perhaps a little bit perplexed by it as well.
Yeah, he could have done with a bit more help today. I mean, certainly there were positions he found himself in where an extra pair of legs just to help the chase certainly would have done him a few favours. You know, he was kind of encouraging all of the others to come through when Yates was down the road. But they were all on their own at that point, and they all really had a common interest but didn't necessarily work that well together. And Pino's answer to that was attacking and just going as hard as he could. But I think he had a bit of a sort of score to settle after yesterday. He wasn't very happy after the stage to onto the up the Zonkerland, and he felt that he needed to pull something out today.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Independent research shows 10% of sports nutrition products would get a professional rider banned. Trust science in sport, the world's highest standard of banned substance testing.
Thank you to Science and Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. As I mentioned earlier, you can win some Science and Sport stuff by entering our competition. You can also get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. And speaking of nutrition, we are tonight sipping some Italian beer, La Bassa, made by Brewfist. And this is Italian craft beer that was sent to us by a friend of the podcast, Alessio Leone. Thank you, Alessio. He's shipped out from London to our hotel in Italy yesterday. I'm very appreciative of that. A little case of the beer.
It's got a nice pink label, lid, and
a cyclist.
A little almost one of those sort of medical dummy type cyclists. Do you know what I mean? Skeleton type thing.
We'll post a picture of it on Twitter and Instagram. So what other odds and sods from today? I think you had a quick word with Chris Froome.
I didn't really, because the Italian TV had first dibs on Chris Froome after the finish, and he only spoke in Italian. It compliments to Chris Froome on his Italian. He sort of pulled this out from nowhere. We weren't really aware that he spoke.
But he didn't live in Italy for a number of years. We weren't really aware that he spoke
pretty decent Italian. A bit like at the Vuelta last year. He's a bit of a dark horse with languages. He pulled out some Spanish as well last year at the Vuelta. Anyway, let's hear Chris Froome and then I'll give a brief summary.
Sì, molto difficile, però questa è la corsa. Un giorno quando spingi tanto paga il giorno dopo.
Eri stanco da ieri allora?
Sì, ho speso tanto ieri da vincere la tappa e è semplice che non avevo il gambo oggi.
So we've gone from learning Italian with Lionel, learning with Chris Froome.
Chris Froome said that he was tired after yesterday. That's the summary. We went too deep yesterday.
I'm not surprised.
But everyone will have gone deep yesterday, but I think, you know, we all thought the general perception was that he was back, and Dave Brailsford suggested to us yesterday that everything was sort of back on track. And when a rider has really good form, they can absorb intense efforts, can't they? And it doesn't, you know, the excuse that, not an excuse, but the explanation that he gave today wouldn't really stand up or wouldn't really apply to a rider who was in top form. I mean, Yates talked in his press conference about the biggest thing for him in this Giro has not been that he's had these absolutely supersonic days where he's felt incredible. He's just felt that he's recovered very well. So Froome is not quite back to where he needs to be.
Yates is on the front foot, Froome's on the back foot.
But that's the thing. That's the thing about winning Grand Tours, isn't it? It's that combination of endurance and recovery and form, and you know those three things, they all have to be there in some regard. I would say Chris Froome has the endurance, but he doesn't really have the form. Simon Yates certainly has the form at the moment, but there is a question mark about his endurance, because we don't know, you know, it's a very different thing trying to win a Grand Tour in the third week than defending a sort of seventh place or going for a stage win or whatever. But it is one of the things that, you know, Chris Froome's performance has been kind of up and down, and that is in contrast to his Tour de France form or Vuelta form, you know, where he rarely puts a foot wrong. And so, you know, I'm sure a lot of people are watching this thinking, well, what is going on here? Why have we got the wild sort of variations in Froome's form? Some of it will be explained by the couple of crashes he's had and the knocks that he's experienced there. But it is interesting, and obviously
he's getting older. It's his birthday today.
33rd birthday, indeed. Yeah. So, but I mean, obviously, you know, there are the question marks, because he has this salbutamol case hanging over him, and still the uncertainty about what would happen if he were if the adverse analytical finding turned into a suspension at some point. And I've seen a lot of speculation about what would happen to his results in this race. Would he be stripped? I mean, of course, we don't have a definitive answer on what would happen?
Yes, he wouldn't be stripped.
There we are.
It's pretty clearly laid out in the rules, and people cite the Contador case as an example of when Ryder was stripped, but that in that case, it was because Contador had used a period out of racing as credit against his ban, and you can't use it as credit and also keep the results from that period.
And also, clenbuterol is not a substance subject to the adverse analytical finding set of criteria, whereas salbutamol is. And while we're talking salbutamol, it's an asthma medication. One thing we've not really touched on too much is the fact that Simon Yates in 2016 served a four-month suspension for what was described as non-intentional doping after an administrative error. It was basically widely reported that the team had effectively failed to apply for a TUE to cover the use of an asthma medication called terbutaline during Paris-Nice that year. And when this came to light, he was suspended for 4 months. It wasn't kind of a full... They accepted that the team had not, basically cocked up and put him in that position. It's interesting, isn't it, that that story is not kind of taking hold in the same way that the Chris Froome story has done so. And there's a kind of a double standard there. I'm not for 1 minute saying that we should all be coming down heavily on Simon Yates about something that happened a couple of years ago, but there's an inconsistency there too.
Chris Froome is just this lightning rod. I mean, the reaction to his win on Zonkland from some people was quite extraordinary, as if he'd risen from the dead or something. But
as if a four-time Tour de France winner can't win a mountain stage.
Froome, and we've talked about this a lot, but Froome does attract this level of skepticism / cynicism that others don't. And I do think it owes partly to the way that he looks on a bike, fairly or unfairly.
But do you not also think that the we've been led down this path of thinking that consistency is suspicious and inconsistency is suspicious? And bike racing is a complex thing. There's 175 people all experiencing ups and downs every day, and sometimes we always say about a rider who wins the Tour generally is somebody who avoids crashes, who is ultra consistent and has the form, ticks all of those boxes. That's what it takes to win a Grand Tour.
But they're not machines. And Simon Yates, we're 2/3 of the way through the Giro. We were watching him on a wet descent today, and I was saying in a second his Giro could disappear, as it did for Stephen Kruijswijk a couple of years ago. Looked to be homing in on winning the Giro, didn't. Will he win a Grand Tour now? Perhaps not. And the margins are very thin. And we saw today Fabio Aru, again, another rider who has won Grand Tours in the past, is not himself here. And it was shades of Iban Mayo at the Tour a few years ago when he appeared to be wanting to quit and his team were forcing him to carry on.
Yeah, it's just a nightmare for him. Ciro and a couple of Italian journalists were talking at the finish about how Aru, maybe needs to revise his racing programs because he races very little in the lead up to Grand Tours, and they were comparing the kind of apprenticeship that he served with Simon Yates. Simon Yates has ridden a lot of different types of race. Aru has almost ridden no one day races in his career, the bottom line is he just doesn't have any form, and he's repeated the sort of build up he's had in the past, but it just hasn't worked this time.
Would you not think if he wanted to quit this race it would be smart, because he could still go to the Tour de France, and if they can pull their act together in the next 5-6 weeks, Aru and Dan Martin, that is not a bad lineup to go to the Tour de France with, is it?
It happened last year, didn't it? He went to the Tour because he couldn't ride the Giro, and he rode extremely well at the Tour. So there's a precedent for that. Daniel, where were you today?
What do you mean?
You weren't around.
We're talking about that later.
We're talking about that later, sorry.
And we're going to Ecuador first.
Oh, Ecuador.
Well, there was a cracking, stonking ride today from an Ecuadorian rider, Richard Carapaz. And he is really, breathing down the neck of Miguel Angel Lopez, whose Giro has been a little bit disappointing so far. Disappointing in the sense that if you had said before the Giro that one of Yates or Lopez was going to be a real factor in the race for Pink, then you would have said Lopez.
I said Yates in our Giro preview. I'd like to point people back to that.
However, Carapaz is overshadowing Lopez, I would suggest. And I spoke to his direct sportif, Jose Vicente Garcia Acosta at the finish today?
Bueno, sabemos que está muy bien. Sabemos que está muy bien.
We know that he's going really well, but yes, he is surprising us every day. And we don't know how far he could go. Yesterday he had a bad day, partly because of a lack of experience on the climb, which can happen. Conversely, today was really hard, but he rode an incredible stage. As for goals, we still have to take it one day at a time, because this is the first time he's gone for the GC in a Grand Tour. We don't know how he'll recover. It's true that he can be inspired by what Simon Yates is doing here. They're very similar riders, of a similar age. But I'm still a fan of taking things very slowly, day by day.
Well, Miguel Angel Lopez and Carapaz are split by only 20 seconds in the race for the white jersey for best young rider. Carapaz held that since winning his stage last week. Lopez took it on Montes Oncalan. But those two have got previous Grand Tour experience. The highest placed Grand Tour debutant at the moment is Ben O'Connor from Perth, Western Australia, riding for Dimension Data. A few people asked us to have a word with him. So at the finish, I went to the Dimension Data bus and I started by asking him how the Giro compared to the Tour of the Alps, because he won a stage of the Tour of the Alps and that was the result that really brought him to our attention only a few weeks ago, not all that far from here.
Obviously, it's a big step up. People have just those extra tweaks and in power, especially the it's just that little bit above threshold where guys can just really rip it to shreds. And if you can't do that, you can just sit at your threshold and just try and kind of hang on. You also have everyone, kind of all the teams in terms of this 18 World Tour teams, not seven or so. That also makes a big difference because of the lead-ins to the climbs. Here, now that it's mountains all day, it's not so much of a difference, but when it's one big climb, the run-in is really incredible. It's really hard and you spend a lot of energy going into it, so that's one of the big differences I found.
In terms of being 2 weeks into the race, how do you feel you're holding up? You're obviously riding extremely well, but do you know like how much you've got left for the final week?
I have no idea. I felt a bit tired this morning. It was probably the first day that I felt, the body just, it's not so much soreness, it's just like you want to stretch, but I think Zonkalan does that as well because you're pulling and tugging for 40 minutes or 35 minutes, whatever it was, in agony. So I feel okay. I definitely feel better than what I thought I was going to do. I thought by now maybe I would have had a bad day and struggle, but I know my body is it's classic me. It's does well in endurance and doesn't tend to kind of get worse. It kind of stays the same, so I guess that's a good attribute.
So physically holding up well, but what about mentally? Because I'm assuming you've never done anything of this duration before, certainly not at this level.
I think the mental side thing is important to have, especially when you finish the race, just either someone to talk to or people to speak to away from the race. Otherwise, it's a long time. Otherwise, you get caught completely up into bike riding for a month, and I feel that's a lot. And then also, it's just the actual racing itself, in especially down in the south with those narrow roads, it was super stressful. There was many times when you were that close from giving up. You were so just you were about to lose your mind, but then you eventually come round.
In a funny way, you're finding racing here a bit more liberating because perhaps the stress is a bit lower and you're more in your element.
In the mountains? Ah, for sure. I mean, this is my element here. It's the stressful, punchy little hilly days. They are fun, albeit, but they are stressy. So I much prefer it here. And this region in particular, I think the Sud Tirol, Dolomites, it's one of my favorite regions by far. I came here last year for a training camp. I did a couple stages in Tour of Austria that weren't too far from here, and then obviously Tour of Alps was all in Sud Tirol, so I have a nice little affiliation, if you could say, with it. So yeah.
And in terms of your teammates, you've got some very experienced guys here. I know Igor Anton has gone home, but I mean, how much help have your teammates given you in the first 2 weeks of the race?
They have been really good. I mean, we don't have... I mean, sadly for Igor, he's been struggling, and yesterday he was amazing, but I think he paid for it today. So we've had a couple illness problems, so not all the guys have been clicking super well, but to be honest, when you get up into these mountains, it doesn't matter all so much. It's more about the run-ins to the climbs, and then once you're there, you're there. The big teams tend to have that under control.
And lastly, once the time trial's out of the way, there's quite a lot of climbing back to back to back. I mean, what are you hoping for, and how do you think you feel?
Just the same as now. Really just the same as now. Be in the front group as long as I can, and that's it.
So that was Ben O'Connor, interesting young man, having a good race for a team.
He used to play cricket, didn't he? He used to be a cricketer. He's got the build for... I would suggest he would have been a Richard Jürgen glaze over now, but I would suggest he's quite a good seam bowler.
Don't know what that means.
Yeah, I would suggest that he could get a bit of movement off the seam on. You give him a good pitch, give him a nice green pitch in April in north of England.
While we're going off piece nice like this, I should just say movement. That the Flying Haggis nickname was coined by somebody on Instagram, and I don't want to take credit for that myself, but it made me chuckle. Where were you today, Daniel?
I was in Austria.
Brilliant.
That's true.
Brilliant. Yeah, I mean, no, Lionel, it's factually correct.
Lionel,
what were you doing there?
Lionel cast aspersions on my ability to relay factual knowledge or factual information.
Well, it sometimes appears beneath you.
Anyway, yeah, I was in Austria.
Say stuff like that and then just...
I even had to buy. Do you know, I haven't even told you about this yet. I even had to buy a vignette to drive on the motorway in Austria. You know, as soon as you go into Austria, you have to pay to go on the motorway. It's like Switzerland. Anyway, why was I there? Marco Haller, the Katusha Alpecin rider, had a terrible crash in training a few weeks ago at the end of April. Well, mid to late April. He was out training with his countryman and, well, near neighbour in Klagenfurt in the south of Austria, Bernie Eisel, who by coincidence was also at the Giro d'Italia today. And by a further coincidence, had a terrible... Well, it didn't seem a particularly bad crash at the time at Tirreno Adriatico in March. However, about 4 weeks later, Bernie Eisel started developing headaches. And he was feeling pretty under the weather and groggy when he went out on this day in late April with Marco Haller. Marco Haller got hit by a car and had a catastrophic crash. And then a day later, Bernie Eisel also ended up in hospital because of the legacy, the after effects of the crash he'd had in Tirreno. Anyway, Richard, we're going to follow Marco Haller throughout his recovery and his rehab. It's going to be a long one. It's going to take several months. But here are Marco and Bernie, who was at the Giro today, working for Eurosport, talking about the crash in April.
I met Bernie for a ride. It was actually our second ride. Super weather, everything was nice, and had a good chat there. And suddenly, this car pops out, you know. And then, as I said, immediately I knew it was a bad crash because it was really like you hit the wall, you know.
Yeah.
This car come out, and then in the last moment, it ceases again, and stops. Because if it continues, also Bernie goes in. He was on the left, and he just managed to go around in front, by centimeters.
If he hits the car with the head, he's probably dead, you know. It was really, you get goosebumps.
It's it was pretty much 4 weeks after my crash, and that hematoma that was building up and has just started causing... 2-3 days before the crash with Marco, it started causing a massive headache to me, and it just got worse day by day. And I've spoken to the doctors, especially. They said it's really it's a miracle how you got around the car, because my brain, with the hematoma being so big, moved 8 millimeters out of the middle, pushing against the right side of my skull. And normally you actually have problems to walk or in a straight line, because you can't balance yourself anymore, because your brain is out of the middle. And so it's I was honestly super, super lucky, because if I also hit the car, land on my head, it could have been the end.
So, Daniel, this is going to be a Friends of the Podcast special released.
We hope so. We might get scooped, though. I mean, now that we've revealed it, a bigger, richer, more organisation might come along.
No, but he's promised us exclusivity.
Well, he has promised, but...
So, we're going to exclusively follow Marco Haller's rehabilitation.
Sky Sports might come in and offer him $10 million
Never
for
heard
the,
of them.
The
Never
exclusive.
Heard of them. Anyway, it's going to be fascinating, and it's going to come out as a Friends special sometime in the future. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. Sign up for £15.
Why are you looking at me? Are you looking at me accusing me?
Because you haven't signed up.
No, I haven't signed up.
And
because I'm still waiting to be reimbursed for the €8 I spent on the vignette and on the,
so
for the motorway
some,
in Austria.
At least one of you
also
sign
ended
up
having to buy dinner last night.
Hefty old bill for dinner last night that I got on my own personal card. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, if you're a friend of the podcast, you can also get the 3 times a week episodes of Kilometer Zero at the Giro d'Italia. As Lionel said earlier, episode 7 comes out tomorrow morning, Monday. 8 and 9 will be Wednesday and Friday. So they've been great so far. I can say that because I haven't been involved in them, but they've been really, really excellent. Should we wrap things up there?
Yeah.
And say arrivederci to Lionel. See you, Lionel.
Thanks, Rich. It's been great. Thank you, Daniel, for your company. Booked some fantastic hotels. I mean, it's been, well, there hasn't been a dud in 2 weeks, which is, I've been really, really impressed with. We'll say nothing about Lionel Learns
get
Italian.
Careful, this doesn't get condescending, Lionel. No.
Wow.
I mean, you're going to get emotional.
Well,
I don't think it's going to get emotional here.
You'll spot that.
It's speech time. Come on. Lionel, you've said you're a bit Daniel. Do you want to return?
Lionel's, you know, great. He's been...
this is hard work for him, isn't it?
He's been a fantastic travelling companion. His ability to withstand stress has improved markedly since last year, and I look forward to it improving further over the next 12 months.
Very interesting. Well, just finally,
that's like the least positive school report ever written.
A final act of rebellion, and while Daniel was away, while the mouse was away, we had a cappuccino
mouse.
At 12. Sorry, the cat. I'm getting confused. I'm getting a mice and my cat's confused. We had a cappuccino at 12:17 p.m.
Yeah, the woman did look at us a little bit strangely.
To be
fair.
I hope she did.
Didn't she?
I hope there was lots of tutting.
It was very nice. Anyway, Lionel, the time has come to say arrivederci.
Yeah, it's been brilliant. I'm quite disappointed to be leaving, but I'm looking forward to watching the rest of the race on the TV and listening to the podcast each morning. I'm not going to listen to it in the evening. It's too late.
Might be earlier. Might be earlier next week.
Well,
be less, slightly more to the point, a bit less long-winded, perhaps. A few fewer deviations into food and stuff.
No, I'm not sure about that. Anyway.
Oh, okay, fine.
Might be two cycling podcasts next week. There might be a splinter cycling podcast next week.
Anyway, thanks, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
On behalf of the listeners.
Thank you, Daniel. Not for yourself, okay.
It wouldn't be a podcast featuring Lionel Burney if there wasn't a major omission. And as we turn off our recorders tonight, we realise we forgot to mention Nicholas Roach abandoned. First Grand Tour he's ever abandoned, but also on a very significant stage for the family, the Roach family, because it was on the stage to Sapada in 1987 that Stephen Roach snatched laid the groundwork to win the Giro ahead of his teammate Roberto Vicentini. That was the subject of a French special that we recorded last year, Roach's story of his win at the 1987 Giro. But yeah, we forgot to mention that, didn't we, Lionel?
We did. It was on my notes that Roach had abandoned, but the tail of the tapper was going a bit long and I could see people losing interest and rolling their eyes.
People? What, me and Daniel?
Well, no, just Daniel. He's gone now, so I can say that.
Se lo mangiano le femmine.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Ci sono nella tua nave.
dalla delle